This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I don't usually talk about my marriage on Fresh Air, but you can imagine my surprise when I recently saw a document indicating that my husband lived at several other addresses, under different names, and was deep in debt. Tracking down leads from this document showed that he owed child support payments to another woman and back payments on an auto loan when all these years he told me he didn't know how to drive. What was going on? Well, the document I refer to was a report from a credit rating agency. It was easy for my husband to convince me the agency had made some big mistakes. It was much more difficult to convince the agency. That required help from a lawyer. I offer this as an example of why you might want to know what your credit rating is and who compiles these ratings and how they do it. Here to answer these questions and more is Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren. She specializes in credit card and bankruptcy law. Her books include The Two Income Trap, Why Middle Class Mothers and Fathers Are Going Broke. Elizabeth Warren, welcome back to Fresh Air. Now, I understand why identity theft would mess up a credit rating, but in my husband's case, it wasn't even identity theft. It was clerical error. It was just like administrative errors. There were several different names and addresses on my husband's credit report. The other people didn't have the same name that he has. How can that happen?
Well, it happens because there's no real check on the system. Estimates are that about 80% of credit reports contain at least one error, and one in four credit reports contain errors big enough to make a difference in your credit rating. I hate to say this, but your husband is not only not alone, he's part of a fairly large group of Americans who have credit reports that just don't reflect who they are.
So what are the consequences when there are errors in your report and you are consequently the owner of a lower credit rating than you ought to be?
Well, you know, everyone thinks about it will matter if I try to take out credit. Everyone understands that. That's why they're called credit reports. So it would make a difference if you were trying to buy a house. It might make a difference in the interest rate you get on a credit card or a car loan. But what surprises a lot of people is it makes differences in other areas. So, for example, did you know that you might pay a different price to buy a car for cash if you had a different credit rating?
Why?
Well, there are studies showing that when they find out who you are and they get ready to shoot you a price, that car salespeople run your name through and do a credit check, even if you're going to pay cash, and that they actually quote different prices to people with impaired credit. That's before they get into the question of charging them more for financing. Or how about car insurance? Insurance companies check your credit rating, and if you have a low credit score, they charge somewhere in the neighborhood of $100 to $200 more on your insurance than they otherwise would.
What are some of the other surprising places that use your credit report?
Jobs. When you apply for jobs, some people estimate now that about 70% of employers do credit checks, and they just don't hire the people who have impaired credit. Trying to rent an apartment, there are landlords who won't rent to people who have impaired credit, even if they have a deposit and are paying in advance. Utilities. There are utility companies that run a credit check, and they make the size of your deposit depend on what your credit score is. Cell phone plans. You get different phone plans based on whether or not you have high credit scores or low credit scores. Access to student loans. So there are lots of places where credit scores matter besides buying a house and taking out a credit card. And believe me, I don't mean to diminish those because that matters and matters a lot to people who get caught there.
Well, there are three big credit report agencies, Experian, TransUnion, and Equifax. How do they get their information?
They get their information from lots of places. Mostly, they get it from voluntary reports from creditors. So when you take out a loan, your lending company tells the credit reporting agency, I've just lent this much money to Terry Gross, and then makes a report of what Terry Gross's regular payments are. And not surprisingly, that's where a lot of mistakes creep into the system. They get a number wrong, they get an identification wrong, they get your Social Security number wrong, and so the wrong information gets attached to a particular person. The credit reporting agencies, though, also scour the public records. So they look for things like bankruptcies and foreclosures and tax deficiencies, liens, anything, lawsuits that get posted in the public records. And again, they try to make the match between Terry Gross, Philadelphia, looks like maybe the right address, or maybe not, and then link it up with public records. In fact, it very well may be that's part of what happened to your husband. Once they get a wrong link in there, then they're not only looking for the person at your current address, they're linking information to somebody who lived at a different address. And so the mistake just keeps multiplying. A tiny little mistake gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
So there's three different credit rating agencies, and what I learned is that they might have three different scores for you, or one of them might have a really negative score for you with a lot of mistakes, while the other two have a higher score with either no mistakes or at least fewer mistakes. Why are there discrepancies?
Isn't that amazing? It's because the credit reporting agencies each gather their information independently, although overlapping. They may do cross-reporting, but they also, there are two different things. There's different information that goes into the report. So someone may have picked up a foreclosure in Montgomery County that the other two agencies didn't pick up, and that could be correct or erroneous, but it would start making those reports look different from each other. But in addition to that, they all run their own subroutines on the reports. You know, the report is not just a blip of information. They don't just hand your employer or the person who's going to lend you money just all of the information and let them kind of sort through it. They give it a score. You're a 590 or a 640 or a 720. And the way they calculate that score is a trade secret, which is another way of saying you and I can't know what it is. All we can know is what information went into it, and then if they want to weight information differently, they want to say, well, you know, that's an old report, this is a new report, that's a foreclosure, and we think that's a huge ding, somebody else thinks it's a moderate ding. All those sorts of things will be weighted differently in the calculation that goes into that final number, and that's how you end up with different numbers.
So when somebody's getting wants to check your credit, do they check all three agencies or just one of them?
Most of the time they check just one because it's cheaper. And most of the time they have an ongoing relationship. These companies, Experian, for example, does about somewhere in the neighborhood of about $1.5 billion in revenues. They're out there selling their product to potential users, and they set up a cheaper arrangement if you will come to Experian with all of your queries. So that's what most of the folks do. They check with the one that they have a set up relationship with.
Now let me get back to my husband's case for a second. As I mentioned, his credit rating on one of the reports had suddenly taken a nosedive because they had several other different men included in his report, and these men all owed money. So how do other people's names end up on your credit report when it's not a case of identity theft? No one had stolen his credit card numbers or his Social Security number, as far as we know. His credit card bills hadn't been charged for false charges. So how can an error of that magnitude or several errors of that magnitude be made?
Well, you have to remember, they're collecting literally millions of bits of information every single day on about 280 million Americans. And the data are not well designed always to identify just your husband and sort him out from everyone else. The way a computer scientist would describe it, it's a noisy system. It's got a lot of stuff going on in it. And what happens is a credit reporting agency picks up someone with a similar name, or someone that's just one number off on a Social Security number, or someone that had a credit card that was one number different. And once they get it in, their view is that becomes truth. And now it's up to your husband to figure out how to pry the thing out of there. They have truth in their view. You know, you have to keep in mind, they don't have a lot of incentives to spend a whole lot of money to drive these errors out of the system. These three businesses are doing great. They're making a lot of money. And the fact that there are a lot of errors in it, they have managed thus far to make that the customer's problem rather than the company's problem.
You know, some people have strategies for trying to improve their credit rating, either by opening new credit cards or closing cards that they're not using, or paying off cards that they were in debt on and closing those. Do you know for sure that any of these strategies actually work?
No. And again, because you can't know with a black box what's going to make a difference. But there are some that we've begun to realize. You know, there's enough repeated experience here that, for example, having a credit card for a very long period of time seems to improve people's credit scores. And we just infer that from lots of people comparing their credit scores and talking about what changes if they cancel an old card. So what that tells you, if you wanted to be strategic, is, well, you might try not canceling old credit cards. Isn't that a kind of an amazing thing? You're not using them, but keep them out there. Keep them alive. Continue to accept the card, because a long credit history is better than a short credit history. Or, for example, here's another one, not using more than half of your available credit limit is another device that will make you, we think, look better to a credit reporting company. So, for example, if all your credit cards together added up to, let's just say, $25,000 worth of credit, and you were going to borrow $15,000, you'd be better off to open a new credit card giving you another $10,000 worth of credit so that you wouldn't go past the halfway mark on all available credit. But I got to tell you about these strategies. We think they work, but nobody knows the actual formulas because the three credit reporting companies will not tell.
Now, you're looking at the credit report agencies from the perspective of the consumer. So from the perspective of the consumer, what's your critique of what's wrong with the system?
Well, I think what bothers me most is this is information about me. This is information about the consumer. And this information is gathered by somebody else and then sold to somebody different without my permission and without the permission of any other customer. And if there are errors in the system, or if I want to understand what would make my score better and what would make my score worse, there's no transparency in this. It's, yes, finally, under federal law, we're allowed to look at our credit reports once a year for free. Other than that, we have to pay. And even when we pay, we're still not seeing what the formula is that determines the number that will be given to our employer or to our insurance company that might make a difference in whether or not they would hire us or whether or not they would charge us more for insurance. In other words, what I don't like about this system is I don't like the fact that it's my information and it's non-transparent about how it's being used. Maybe it's being used for good purposes. Maybe it's being used righteously, but I can't tell.
So how do you get a copy of your credit reports so you can figure out if yours is reasonably accurate?
Well, it's not hard. Anybody who's got a computer can just go online and type in credit report and get 8 trillion offers for your, you know, to give you your credit report. Of course, what they'll also want to do is try to sign you up for a service or, you know, where they'll, for a low fee, they will continue to monitor your credit report for you. Talk about a scam. You want to hear that scam? They then will send you a little piece of information to tell you there's been a change in your credit score. But if you want to find out what it is, you've got to buy another credit report. So there are plenty of opportunities to get them. You can get them online. But what you want to look for is to get one free if you haven't had one within a year. And you can get those directly from the three companies. You can just go to their website, type in your information, and they will send you a copy of your credit report. They're required to. It's federal law. They're not being nice. They're complying with the law.
Okay, so say you've gotten a free copy of your report and you see errors on it. Then what do you do?
Well, now the fun begins, because the first thing is they're hard to read. They're not set up to be read by one-time readers. But let's say you sit down and you look at it and you say there's a mistake here. What you want to do at that point is you want to go through the credit reporting agency and report the error, and you want to save a record, do it in writing, send them a letter, do it by email and print it up, because they, again, by law, are required to investigate. And if it turns out that the information listed is wrong by law within 30 days, if they haven't heard back from the original person who put the information in, they're required to remove it from your credit report. Now, as you learned, that's the law, but the agency may say, well, we have evidence here, we got some information, or they just flat leave it in and they wait for you to come after them with hammer and tongs to try to get it out of there.
The good news is if you retain a lawyer to help you, because a lawyer knows how to do it and has the clout to do it, if you're right and the credit reporting agency is wrong, they're required to pay the legal fees.
That's right. That's right. But, you know, that's setting a pretty high bar to straighten out your own information about yourself.
Sure is.
Yeah. Costs a lot of money. And it also costs an enormous amount of aggravation.
And time.
And time. It's upsetting to people.
If a credit rating agency has made a mistake with your rating, you discover it and you challenge it. Do they end up making money on you through fees because each time you request a report to see if they changed your report and made it more accurate, you have to pay a fee to them in order to for the privilege of seeing if they corrected the mistake?
Well, they owe you a free one. But after that, if you've lost confidence in the company and you just want to make, let's say, a monthly check to make sure the information's gone and then it stays gone, that's all on you.
So their inaccuracies in some ways make money for them because the more worried you are about their accuracy, the more you got to pay them.
The more worried you are, the more money you spend with the credit reporting agency. Great system, huh?
If you want to actually reach someone at a credit reporting agency and explain to them what the problem is behind a mistake, how easy is it going to be to reach an actual person who's going to talk with you and is in a position to do something about the problem?
I have to say, I don't know, because I've never been able to do it. I've tried. And all I ever get are the endless loops of phone trees and, you know, press one. And the best I've ever done is by email. So I am no help here on how to find a live human being because I don't know how to do it.
Are there any reforms in the works?
Not really. You know, I shouldn't be so flip. Congressman Mel Watt held hearings. He held two sets of hearings this past year, looking into some of the abuses with credit reporting agencies. And there have been a lot of independent studies trying to show the error rate and trying to push on the companies to bring down the error rate and make it easier to correct errors. But the bottom line is that even the FTC, which takes in the complaints about credit reports, they take the position that your credit report is not owned by you. It's owned by somebody else. And the fact that, you know, it may cost you money, that they may have told what are in effect lies about you, that's your problem to straighten out, not the problem of the credit reporting agencies. And I think so long as we start with that mindset, it's not going to get a lot better. We really do have to think about this differently.
Well, Elizabeth Warren, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about credit ratings.
I'm glad to do it.
Elizabeth Warren is a professor at Harvard Law School. We'll close this half hour with a song from a new CD by singer Rebecca Kilgore and pianist Dave Frischberg, who've performed several times on Fresh Air. Their new CD features songs by Frank Lesser. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Hancock, the big-budget holiday weekend movie opening tomorrow, stars Will Smith as a reluctant, rude, unpopular superhero. Our guest, Jason Bateman, co-stars as Ray, a public relations expert who takes on the abrasive Hancock as a client after the superhero rescues him. The movie also co-stars Charlize Theron as Ray's wife and is directed by Peter Berg, who produced both the movie and TV versions of Friday Night Lights. Jason Bateman has drawn acclaim recently for small but impressive supporting roles in such movies as Juno, in which he and Jennifer Garner played the couple planning to adopt Juno's baby, and Smoke and Aces. Those roles came after his 2003 TV showcase role in the Fox sitcom Arrested Development. He starred as Michael Bluth, the one seemingly sane character surrounded by a gaggle of crazy family members. But long before that, Jason Bateman tasted stardom as a child, beginning in the early 80s with regular roles on Little House on the Prairie and Silver Spoons. Our TV critic David Bianculli spoke to Jason Bateman. Let's start with a clip from Hancock. After the drunken Hancock saves Ray, Jason Bateman's character, Ray invites Hancock over for dinner with his wife and son.
Aaron, pal, how was school today, huh?
Fine.
Yeah, no more problems with that bully Michael?
Michelle.
Michelle is this neighborhood bully. We've been trying to teach Aaron a little bit about conflict resolution. Mm. You know what I mean?
Yeah, turn the other cheek, all
that's
that.
That's exactly mm-hmm. right.
Mm-hmm. Well, just never turn that one, all right? Uh-huh. Never let them punk you.
Got it.
Okay, Aaron, eat your food.
Well, you deal with bullies, you take your right foot, bring it right up, catch him in his little...
Please, just stop. Michelle is not a man, okay? He's a little boy, and his parents happen to be going through a really, really bad divorce, and that's why he's acting up. And maybe you don't know this, but not everything in this world gets resolved with brute force. Not everything has to be bang, scream, blood, more blood, you know,
Angel.
Just destruction.
We're okay. She watches so much news that sometimes it gets to be a little too much.
You got a toilet?
Yep. Yeah, just pass the fridge.
Did he just take the whiskey bottle to the bathroom?
Do you want him to kill us all?
Jason Bateman, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
Your new movie is Hancock. It stars Will Smith in the title role, and he's playing a guy with superpowers, but a very bad attitude and reputation. And you play Ray, a public relations guy who tries to polish Hancock's image. I was really surprised when I saw a preview of the movie that you were as much the leading man as Will Smith was. I mean, it's your character's story as much as it is his. So how did you get this role, and how long ago did you know you had it?
Well, I did a film with Peter Berg called The Kingdom, and we were working together for quite some time. And you can accrue quite a number of incriminating photos on somebody when, when you're spending that much time with them. So I cashed those in for this part.
What was it about Peter Berg? I mean, he also did the movie and TV versions of Friday Night Lights, and he really seems to know how to get great natural stuff out of his actors, and he responds to actors where he seems to be looking for something particular in them. Why did you two guys connect?
I'm not sure. I would hate to look too closely at it for fear of screwing it up, but my guess would be that his approach to directing is fairly similar to my approach to acting, in that we try to keep things kind of simple and we don't try to overthink it and make it too precious. Whatever it is, it does seem to work. He likes to keep things very, very natural and very, very loose. I mean, he does like to get the scene shot as written, but once that is done, he definitely encourages you to go off the page and try to find some of that natural stuff that ends up being pretty funny.
You have said that you have sort of a plan for building stardom the second time, you know, going for roles that aren't necessarily above the title but that appeal to you. And you can see that plan in Juno. I was really impressed by the shadings that you gave to that character, which starts off as a very likable character and needs to be a very likable character and then slowly turns over the course of the movie. That seems like, even on paper, it would have been a wonderful role to play. But I wonder, was it a wonderful role to think about how to play?
Yeah. You know, reading the script, there's a final scene, or sort of the peak scene for my character with Juno, where we're dancing in this basement, and things get a little creepy, and I let her know that I'm leaving my wife, and the dialogue as written, as read, points you, the reader, and me, the actor, trying to figure out who this guy is and what his intentions are in all the scenes preceding this, in a particular direction, a direction of, well, I think he might be trying to hit on this girl. And Jason Reitman, the director, He and I, we had discussions about this quite a bit leading up to shooting that scene through the rehearsal process and in all the days of shooting before we got to that day. And I wanted to know, am I trying to sleep with this girl? Am I trying, you know, am I hitting on her? Mm-hmm. Or am I just looking for a peer relationship, sort of a connection? Because if it is the latter, then that informs how I play the scenes beforehand with my wife. And if it is the former, that's going to inform how I play the scenes with Juno. That precede that scene. So,
well, before you say which way you decided, let's hear the scene. This is Jason Bateman and Ellen Page in Juno.
I'm leaving, Vanessa.
What?
Getting a place in the city, got it all planned. This is something I've been wanting to do for a long time.
No.
No?
No, you definitely can't do that. That's one big fat sack of... No.
What is the matter?
I mean, you guys are supposed to take care of this, you know?
Thought you'd be cool with this.
Cool? I want things to be perfect. I don't want them to be shitty and broken like everyone else's family. Come on, look, I'll have the baby, and Vanessa's gonna be so happy. You just... The
baby's not gonna fix everything. Besides, I don't know if I'm even ready to be a father.
But you're old.
How do you think of me? You know, why are you over here?
I just like being a piece of furniture in your weird life.
This is what my life has become. I mean, you know, I got stuff in boxes, you know, I'm underground. That's appealing to you?
Is this my fault?
No.
Is Vanessa, like, mad at you because of me or something?
It's got nothing to do with it. Vanessa and I aren't in love anymore.
Well, you were in love when you married her. And if you're in love once, you can be in love again. Like my friend Leah, who's been with the same guy, like... four different times. You're just not trying hard enough.
Such an idiot. I can't believe what an idiot.
No, you know what, Mark? Oh, just do not divorce your wife. Will you please just do me a solid and stay with Vanessa?
You're so young.
All right. So what did you decide? How did you decide to play it?
Basically, the short answer is I went for a 70-30 sort of ratio there between, and the 70 being going for a friendship and a connection there as a result of being lonely in my marriage. And the 30% was somewhat more, you know, lascivious, but only perhaps developing maybe 2 or 3 months down the road. So... it came as a result of the conversations with Jason Reitman, the director, and trying to figure out what we should be playing here. Now, he was consistently saying to me, I'd like for you to play both. I understood where he was coming from, and ultimately that did work. But it was frustrating to me as an actor that I didn't want to get caught in no man's land, and I needed to know which side he wanted me to be, and then from there I would play it somewhat vague or ambiguous. So he ended up saying to me, "Well, you know, why don't you just decide and just know what my desires are?" And so the way that we went about doing it was, we shot the scene, that particular scene, about, I don't know, let's say 10 times. It might have actually been exactly 10. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, in the first take, I'm going to play as meek and as vulnerable and as solicitous of friendship with her as possible. And by the 10th take, I will be a real creep. And, you know, I will come across like I'm trying to, you know, make it all happen right there on the couch right then. And the agreement was that once he gets in the editing room, he would cobble together a performance out of those 10 takes. And he did that. And I thank him so much for putting the scene together like that and helping me execute that fence riding that he wanted so badly.
Let's get back to the interview. Our TV critic David Bianculli recorded with Jason Bateman. Bateman's new film Hancock opens tomorrow.
I've got to say this in a way that sounds like the compliment I intend it to be rather than the insult that you might take it as.
Oh, boy.
But
here it comes.
No. I've been a TV critic forever. Silver Spoons I reviewed when it came out. Wow. By the time Arrested Development came out, I was so pleasantly stunned by your performance in the pilot for that show and then everything you did since then, that I have to admit that part of the joy was I didn't know that you had it in you. And
yeah.
And I know that that sounds kind of insulting. I really don't mean it that way.
No. I get what you're saying.
And I'm wondering, did you know you had it in you?
Well, I mean, yes. I mean, you hope to sort of talk yourself into that. But, you know, my mother is British, and so she gave me this very sort of dry, sarcastic sense of humor. And that works in some projects better than others. It's more appropriate. In multi-camera television, in sitcoms, you know, when you have a studio audience, there is an element of performing that should not be in single-camera comedy. And when I say that, I mean shows in the format of Arrested Development or Curb Your Enthusiasm mm-hmm. or, you know, Sex and City, whatever, you know, that are shot like a movie where there isn't a studio audience and it's not a three-wall set or a laugh track. So I was basically doing my job and fitting the format and fitting the genre when I was doing what I was doing on Silver Spoons or It's Your Move or The Hogan Family or any of the other sort of multi-camera, you know, pilots or shows that I was doing. And that was also coupled with me getting older and having a different sense of humor and becoming a bit more cynical or sarcastic or adult. And the writing supported that. And almost most importantly, I had Jeffrey Tambor. And this is a guy who taught me a lot about, to quote him, not winking. You know, he's got a brand of humor that is very much based in not winking, in playing everything deadly serious, and that is the humor that somebody would say something so absurd with such a straight face and believe it so thoroughly and mm-hmm. deliver it so dramatically that you just empathize with this idiot so much that he's so dumb to treat this subject so seriously that generates the laughter, as opposed to, you know, a pie in the face or some sort of big, broad piece of comedy, which is equally good, but certainly not the brand of humor we were doing here. And it just so happened that Jeffrey had the first line of the first scene of the first show that we did. And he really set the comedic tone for this show. And I fell right into it because I guess I had that desire to do that kind of comedy. And it finally fit in this product.
Let's hear a clip from Arrested Development, one that has you acting opposite Jeffrey Tambor, who plays your father in the show.
Now listen, we can't just go in there and plead not guilty. We have to have someone big behind us, our own private Matlock. So I made some calls and I got him.
Got who?
Andy Griffith. Yeah, you never saw Matlock.
Not a real attorney, Dad.
Now for 10 grand, he'll actually sit behind us in court and read the paper. For 15, he'll actually sit at the defense table. For $20,000, he'll twice lean forward and whisper something in your ear. Oh, white suit, that's extra.
Well, that's an awful lot of money for the stupidest idea I've ever heard.
The juries love him.
That's just it, Dad. There won't be a jury because we are pleading guilty.
I am not guilty. Oh, I didn't want to tell you this. Are you ready for the bombshell?
Andy Griffith wasn't the bombshell?
I'm a patsy. I was set up by the Brits. A group of British builders operating outside the OC contacted me for a partnership to build homes overseas. I did not know they meant Iraq.
We've got a picture of you with Saddam Hussein.
That was Jeffrey Tambor and Jason Bateman in a clip from Arrested Development. What did you learn about yourself and your acting skills and strengths by doing that show?
Basically that you can get it done doing less. And just trust that the camera is watching and you don't need to do a whole lot. Obviously, if the writing is there, you just simply need to open up your mouth and say it and not look in the camera. You know, when you look at somebody like Michael Cera, who, you know, is a guy who I think he was 14 when we started that show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had that already. He had that. That he had such a strong sense of his face and his levels. And he's just so, so gifted at such an early age. That was really, really fortunate that we happened to find him for that character. I mean, I remember us saying, you know, boy, do I look old enough to be his father? Mm-hmm. Because I think at the time we started, I was 35, 34, whatever it was. You know, so what? So I had him when I was 20? I mean, I guess that's not preposterous, but it didn't look like he looked a little bit older than we imagined the actor for the part. But very quickly we got to, well, you know, but hell, are you going to find anybody as good as Michael Cera? And, you know, the quick answer was no, and away we went.
When you're on a set with Michael Cera in Arrested Development or Ellen Page in Juno or any other young actor, because you were a child star, do you have or do you resist the temptation to dispense advice?
I don't resist, but really I haven't had to do that with anybody. You know, Michael's got his head firmly screwed on and is not a real Hollywood guy at all. And I don't know. It's such a tough business for adults. And if you're a kid, it's even tougher. There's a lot of people that are allowing you to be a brat. And the more sort of psychological side of it is somewhat dangerous too, in that you are trying to learn how to be different people at a time when you haven't yet figured out who you are. Mm-hmm. And that can generate
some
schizophrenia. Yeah, I mean, depending on how good you are at it and how sort of deep you want to go in the process, you can kind of mess yourself up. I had some confusing years. I mean, I don't want to say that I developed schizophrenia, but I certainly found a lot of different parts of myself that were becoming very, very fully developed, different personalities that I could justify wearing and living when I might not be instinctually feeling them. So, you know, just rolling out of bed and living with the mood that you are instinctively in sometimes was a challenge. And I had a tough time holding on to teachers. You know, I went through a long list of studio teachers. It got to a point where they wouldn't even send one to the set. It was sort of shut down at one point.
And these are one-on-one tutors, right? So when you're...
Yeah. So there was nowhere to hide when I was being a little bastard. There's a lot of brats out there, and I was certainly one of them.
Your sister, Justine, is also a sitcom veteran from Family Ties, and just as you have reinvented yourself in the last few years, she has too lately, recurring roles on Men in Trees and Desperate Housewives, where she's done very well, and she even guest starred on one Arrested Development. Do you two ever talk about these second act careers you're building and how you're doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been really fortunate that we've been going through this thing all at the same time, and our careers have really paralleled and been able to have somebody so close to talk it all over with. And she voluntarily took quite a bit of time off when she had her two kids, Duke and Gia. And she wanted to be there for those first few years, and now is very eager to get back into it. But, you know, that is a process that it doesn't happen overnight. And, you know, unlike how it did happen for her on Family Ties, I think she was doing some modeling when I was doing, I think I was on to It's Your Move at that point, and she wanted to start being able to maybe stay in nicer hotels or fly maybe in first class or something, going to New York to do some of these modeling things. And so she wanted to start doing some commercial work. And I think she booked three commercials and then read for the pilot of A Family Tie. She read for a guest star part in the pilot, and they liked her so much they wanted her to read for the role of Mallory, which was a series regular, and she got it. You know, this time around, it's a little bit more of the traditional path and pace, and she's fine with it. You know, she's not a rookie. She understands the way the business works and is taking her time and trying to pick the right kind of roles that will generate you know, the kind of career she'd like to have now.
Well, Jason Bateman, thank you very much for being on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jason Bateman speaking with our TV critic David Bianculli. Bateman's new movie Hancock opens tomorrow. The new action-packed movie Wanted was right behind WALL-E at the box office this weekend. It's based on a graphic novel series and stars Angelina Jolie. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
It's a little embarrassing to tell you the plot of the amazingly cool new state-of-the-art thriller Wanted, because it's just so unbelievably stupid. It's derivative to the point where it's insulting to any halfway intelligent viewer. But here's the thing. A good summer thriller has a way of taking halfway intelligent viewers and turning them into half-wits for action. I came out of Wanted on a high. I told friends and colleagues, you gotta see this. It took an hour for my heartbeat to slow and brain to recalibrate, and then I thought, I fell for that? Here's the premise, which is two parts The Matrix to one part The Terminator, with bits of Star Wars, Harry Potter, and the Bourne movies for ballast. All have heroes who suddenly discover their specialness and long-awaited destinies, often along with latent powers they must learn to control. The journey becomes a metaphor for growing up, achieving autonomy, and so on and so forth. In Wanted, skinny Scottish darling James McAvoy puts on an American accent as Wesley Gibson, a timid accountant who gobbles fistfuls of anti-anxiety pills to counter palpitations and visions that look like peculiar wobbles in the space-time continuum. What he doesn't know is that his father, whom he never met, passed down unique genes. See, there's this ancient order of supernaturally gifted assassins presided over by Morgan Freeman. They receive names of people to kill from a giant loom. It's like God is ordering hits, although it's not clear why he couldn't just whack people himself with falling anvils or lightning bolts. Anyway, Wesley goes to refill an anti-anxiety med prescription and finds his jitters are about to increase exponentially. There beside him stands Angelina Jolie. The shot is stunning. Angie's just there.
I'm sorry?
You apologize too much.
Sorry about that.
I knew your father.
My father left the week I was born, so...
Your father died yesterday on the rooftop of the Metropolitan Building. Sorry.
Look, the liquor aisle's just over there, so if you want
to. Your father was one of the greatest assassins who ever lived. The man who killed him is behind you.
There are special effects, and there's Angelina Jolie, who is a natural wonder. Even in what's essentially a supporting role, her aura reshapes every scene. As Fox, that's her name, just Fox, she whisks Wesley out of apparent harm's way by firing bullets that seem like extensions of her will. Then she steers a car with her long legs while directing a fusillade at the Terminator on their tail, a rogue assassin played by Thomas Kretschmann, now picking off old colleagues. And Jolie does everything with a twinkle of amusement, as if the whole gazillion-dollar movie is her little toy. And it is a toy, a big, expensive F.A.O. Schwartz number. Despite the absurd plot, the script is very shapely, with good hairpin turns that flip the stolen Matrix tropes on their head. But the real star of Wanted is the Kazakhstan-born director Timur Bekmambetov, who made the head-trippy Russian vampire opus Night Watch. The guy is a killer when it comes to mixing fast and slow motion in ways that really screw up your biorhythms. Wanted isn't about supernatural assassins. It's about supernatural computer effects. It's about speeds that constantly shift, action that goes forward and backward, and cameras that move in parabolas. You feel as if you're riding on the back of bullets as they arc around objects and hit their human targets with a satisfying splat. Along with every other hyperbolic critical adjective, state of the art has been devalued by overuse. So let's move the boundary posts and proclaim Wanted state of the art, state of the art.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine.